AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson with you here on a Friday afternoon. And our Friday interview today is with Walker Orenstein, who reports on the state legislature for MinnPost. As today we're going to be talking about two articles that Walker recently wrote. One has to do with fuel standards in Minnesota. And one is, well, part of a team that Walker was a part of that has developed a list of who is running in each of Minnesota's 201 legislative races. So we'll be chatting about that a little bit later on. Walker, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So let's start off talking about gas prices, because the article you recently wrote this week is titled "Why High Gas Prices May Doom the Chances of Minnesota Adopting Low Carbon Fuel Standards." So DFLers have been working on this policy for quite some time. I know we don't need to quite get too far into the weeds, but what exactly would this do, this proposal do for fuel suppliers in the state?
Yeah, so in its most basic form, it requires these fuel suppliers. So if you think about someone who supplies gasoline or ethanol, or even sort of an electric car supplier, energy supplier, it would make them just make their product cleaner over time. The policy usually sets kind of a benchmark, you know, a baseline, and it says you need to be, you know, 25% cleaner than this 2018 baseline by 2030, and 75% cleaner by 2040, 100% cleaner by 2050. That's sort of the basics of it. And those are actually the benchmarks set in the latest Democratic proposal. And the idea is just sort of over time, you make fuel suppliers be cleaner in order to slash carbon emissions.
Interesting. And what I found also kind of fascinating about the idea is that there is an off ramp on this, where if fuel prices end up rising too much in the future, well, then the policy would be somewhat suspended for a while. Is that correct?
Yeah, I know that that's one option that House Democrats are looking for, that they've said that they recognize that gas prices, you know, soaring to a certain degree would not be great. And that wouldn't really necessarily prove that the program is functioning as they would envision. And so that they'd like to see that, you know, maybe an off-ramp sort of thing. So if things aren't really functioning as they wanted them to, they could, you know, exit the program or suspend it in some way, alter it in some way in order to sort of escape that possibility. But I haven't heard necessarily what that exact off-ramp would be at this point.
So if we do end up passing these carbon standards in the state, I understand we likely wouldn't feel the impact on gas prices, if there would be any impact, for quite some time, correct? Talk about that and why that might be the case.
It would take certainly a little bit of time. So, you know, there has been some complaints from Republicans about the potential for this to impact gas prices. And we can get into that, the specifics of that more, but it wouldn't impact gas prices until the program is both A, up and running, and B, sort of, as it gets tougher over time, that's when it would have a greater and greater potential impact on gas prices. And so in its really early years, it probably wouldn't have much of an impact. And so if, say, the legislature were to pass it tomorrow, that would, in its current form, would direct the Walz administration to kind of fill in a lot of the details about the program, which includes sort of this complicated exchanging of credit based on whether or not you're meeting the benchmarks in the system. And so they need to fill in that detail. It would probably be a rulemaking process. Those can take months or a year or whatever it might be. And then as it's sort of implemented, the earlier years aren't so impactful. And so like in Oregon, I know in its earliest form, it was like, you know, just a fraction of a cent in 2017 after the program really began in 2016. But in more recent years, that has ticked up a little bit. It's been, you know, 3.7 cents, kind of an additional fuel cost in 2020. Last year, 5 cents. So those aren't nothing. They're not enormous. You know, however you want to categorize a five cent, you know, increase on gasoline. But it is true that in its earliest kind of years, it would take a little while for this to really kick in on fuel prices, is how other states have experienced it, at least.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Oregon, because Minnesota might be using that as a bit of a model for their carbon standards. Of course, three West Coast states have those carbon standards right now: Washington, Oregon, and California. But as I understand it, Minnesota lawmakers are really looking at Oregon as a model, being that they think that state is most similar to how Minnesota might look. So talk a little bit about Oregon's program and how Minnesota is sort of modeling it after them.
Right. So obviously California has this really big, complex economy. And so modeling Minnesota after them, or at least looking to them as what might we expect to experience, it doesn't necessarily provide the closest fit. Oregon makes sense because they're a few years into their program and there's a lot to learn from them. Washington State is still implementing the program. They passed their program really recently, so it hasn't even really started. And so there's not much to model after there. So Oregon has had this for a little while, right? So they can take a look at it. And basically what I know is, you know, there's been a ton of policy work behind the scenes in the background to develop the Minnesota proposal. And it's been done by, you know, legislators and also interest groups, advocacy groups. The Walz administration held like 30 meetings recently to try and hear feedback on a potential low carbon fuel standard, that sort of thing. And I know in particular the Walz administration and generally supporters of a fuel standard have said, you know, we think that we're looking at what the impact in Oregon might be. And also they talked to Oregon, the Walz administration, quite a bit just to learn about some of the technical stuff, you know, implementing the program, the specifics. They gave a special shout out in a report that they wrote, you know, we worked closely with Oregon on this is basically what they said.
So as we take things back to Minnesota, you would naturally think that carbon standards would not be popular with Republicans. And while that is somewhat the case, there are some Republicans in the legislature who are warming up to the idea. So talk about what they find appealing about this idea of bringing these carbon standards to Minnesota and why it does appeal to some Republicans and even those in the ag industry.
Right. Yeah. A lot of Democratic proposals for climate change initiatives don't find a lot of support, if any, among Republicans. But the one kind of wrinkle here is that the low carbon fuel standard is generally thought to be a really good thing for biofuels. So that's your ethanol and your biodiesel. And later on down the road, potentially using that stuff for like jet fuel or something like that. So that really draws a wider range of support. The American Biofuels Coalition supported an earlier version of this proposal in Minnesota. And one of the things they said was, you know, the value of biofuels in California has like quadrupled since the program started, and they're like thrilled about it basically. So for that reason, people like Senator Dave Senjum, who's a Republican from Rochester, he chairs the Energy Committee, pretty influential over in the Senate, has said, you know, if it's good for agriculture, we could be interested. You know, he in fact, it was interesting when I talked to him, he cloaked his interest in the program, though he had some caveats and some things he doesn't like, but he cloaked his interest in the program in right now sort of more traditional Republican phrases and you know, talking points like energy independence. So that's like not being less reliant on foreign oil and stuff. And then the idea is, you know, we're boosting ethanol and that is grown by farmers in the Midwest kind of thing. And the reason that it's helpful for farmers growing ethanol suppliers, biofuel suppliers, is because those products are already generally considered by the government, at least in these formulas, to be, you know, to have fewer carbon emissions. And there's a lot of research and hot debate over the actual carbon emissions of, you know, wide-scale ethanol and those kinds of things. But generally, they're getting credits under this credit program, and generally gasoline suppliers are having to buy credits. They're having deficits. And so for that reason, you know, it can be a really big boost to ethanol, and it still requires those fuels to get cleaner over time. But when these, you know, biofuels associations and growers, they look at something like the Clean Cars Rule, which was another Walz initiative, and that really in some ways focused on electric vehicles, you know, biofuels can see themselves in this proposal, right? You know, it involves us. It involves us getting cleaner over time. It's not just skipping over us and going right to electric vehicles. So I will say some environmental groups would prefer more of a focus on environment or on electric vehicles rather than on biofuels, as this policy does.
So at least in terms of the current legislation or the current session that we're in right now at the state legislature, is there any path forward for the legislation, or is it likely something that we're going to have to possibly implement in the future?
Likely implement in the future. Senator Senjum, who is really the key person on this because it would run through his committee, said he was going to basically have some behind-the-scenes talks with his other colleagues on this, but he said the potential impact to gas prices is one reason why they're not really interested in this year. He says it's not ready for prime time. He's also not really a big fan of the credit trading system that's sort of integral to the bill. He thinks it's overly complicated, and he says, if you can't explain this to your sort of average Minnesotan, if they don't understand it, then we probably shouldn't do it. And I haven't really seen a version of this policy that doesn't have that credit trading system, so I don't really know necessarily how those two things are compatible, though potentially they could be. It's just not up to me. Maybe smarter people are going to figure that out. But so he's basically said, not this session. And who knows whether that means next session is a possibility or 2 years or never or what, but he's interested in it. He sees it as a good idea in theory, but not really something for the near future. Though I will say that there's been, I would phrase it as the Walz administration has not totally closed the door on exploring doing this via rule, as in using existing anti-pollution law to implement this on their own, like they did with the Clean Cars Rule. And so I don't want to suggest that they are certainly going down that road or that they propose going down that road, but I will say they haven't said we don't have the ability to do this, and they haven't said, we're totally shutting the door on that as a possibility. So that's one thing to keep an eye on, if that makes sense.
You can read more about that over at MinPost.com, why high gas prices may doom the chances of Minnesota adopting low-carbon fuel standards. Next piece I want to move on to has to do, I know you were a part of this group that was putting together a list of who is running in all of Minnesota's legislative races. There are 201 of them that are going to be competed for here in 2020. And Walker, I got to imagine this has to be an overwhelming task to put together, to try to get this list put together. And then obviously you have to put which party everyone's running in and where the districts are. And it's a really helpful map that you guys have over at MinPost.com, where it lists every district and then kind of what region it is in the state. So it's very, very helpful. But I imagine that has to be a little bit time consuming, but it is helpful though to look and see who is actually running.
Yeah, we've been working on this here and there for weeks now. And I really, for example, yesterday I spent, about 10 hours just working on this alone, or I guess maybe it was the day before, right before I published. But, it's a haul. I mean, all the little pieces of information about everybody, some people have announced publicly, some people have, a candidate committee, and we've got to go call, hey, are you actually running, that sort of thing. We were talking to people from, the campaign, the House Democratic campaign, the Senate, Republican campaign. We kind of go to the caucus campaigns and say, who do you know that's running and what kind of information do you have? And then we go try and find all that and bring it all together. My longstanding gripe shared by some of my colleagues is that there are too many legislators in Minnesota. And so there's a lot of names because there's a lot of seats out there. And I know that it's possible that we're even missing people as is. So if you happen to know somebody who's still running for office and is running for office, you can definitely email us and let us know, and we're happy to put it on this list. But as far as we know, and especially because people haven't officially filed for office yet, this is that's kind of to come in later months. This is hopefully a pretty complete look at what we know as of now, though it's expected to change as endorsements continue to go, and some people will drop out and some people will announce and that sort of stuff. But we're going to change it as we go.
Yeah, and it's helpful, too, like I mentioned. It lists all of the districts and who's running in there, but more importantly, it says what region that district represents, because oftentimes people will say, for instance, 45B or 63A, what exactly do those districts mean? So that's helpful, and I think it's important to point out, too, you guys are going to keep this updated throughout the year as well over at MinPost.com, correct?
Correct, and also not just do we list the region, but if we have a little button next to each district that says show on map, and it brings up a pretty nifty map that's, you can see exactly where the district is, and I think that's super helpful.
So as we take a look at some of these races, I know you have a particular focus on some of the races in outstate Minnesota. Let's talk about these regional population centers like Rochester or St. Cloud or Moorhead or Duluth, because at least in my mind, those are probably the areas where control of the state legislature is going to be decided. So talk about some of those races in those regional population centers that jumped out at you that might be very competitive this fall.
Of course, and we're one thing to note is we're still sort of getting a sense of this, and you know, there will be future announcements of candidates and stuff, and there's going to be a lot of important races in the suburbs as well. But I focus mainly on Greater Minnesota, and there's definitely action out there. One place I'm looking at is Rochester. That's an interesting one because after redistricting, there's the potential for Democrats to really actually make some inroads there, which is one of the few places that they can actually potentially add seats in Greater Minnesota. You know, some districts now encompass a greater slice of Rochester, basically. Like, for example, I was talking about Senator Senjum. His district in Rochester used to have a lot more rural areas kind of to the west of Rochester and now really encompasses much more of the city itself. And his district is going to be really, really difficult for him, just much more Democratic. St. Cloud is going to be another just really intense swing district. It was last cycle. Eric Putnam, a senator from St. Cloud, won his election in 2020 by like a really ultra slim margin, votes in, I think, the teens or something like that. So that's going to be hotly contested and potentially the House seats in that area as well. Moorhead area is really interesting. Democrats had two legislators in that area who won in districts that voted for Trump really heavily. And so that's Kent Eakin, who's a state senator, and that's Paul Marquardt, who's a state representative from Dilworth. And their districts are, yeah, very heavily Republican when it comes to the top of the ticket. But they have managed to, over the years, win in increasingly difficult sort of races. And both of them are retiring now. And so Republicans think that they can pick up both those seats, and that will probably be pretty important. Another area that will be of interest is the Iron Range. There's some seats still that the Democrats have that Republicans would like to win and think they've got a good shot at. One of those is the district held by Rob Eklund, who's a Democrat from International Falls. There's three Republicans running against him there. That will be a really good and interesting one to watch. There is a seat that Julie Sandstead won just barely last time around that will be hotly contested this time. And actually, she was now in the same district as State Representative Spencer Igo from Grand Rapids, who's a Republican. And so they will have two incumbents, for now at least, facing off against each other. And in the Senate, you know, you've got Tom Bach's seat, who's retiring, who's the former Democrat who became an independent. And so that will be a hotly contested matchup, as will, you know, replacing Senator David Tomasoni, who's also retiring, who also was a Democrat who became an independent. And so those are just a few seats up on the range and kind of the Arrowhead, but there's a lot of action up in those parts.
Yeah, and I imagine the Republicans most certainly are going to be targeting those Bach and Tomasoni seats up on the Iron Range, since those, as you said, were longtime DFL seats until Bach and Tomasoni decided to caucus as independents. Again, you can find a full list of all of those races over at minpost.com. Really helpful guide to figure out who is running for all 201 of Minnesota's seats in the state legislature. We have been speaking with Walker Orenstein, who reports on the state legislature for MinPost. Find his work over again at minpost.com. Walker, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.